Straight out of Finland, this is the Reluctant Theologian Podcast.
Oh, so reluctant.
I am your host, Dr. R.T. Mullins from the University of Helsinki. You've been sending in questions, and today you will get answers. Dr. Emma Sani and I answer some listener questions in today's episode. We look at various issues surrounding God's perfect rationality as it relates to God's goodness and free will. We ask if God can perform arbitrary actions, or if God must always act for a reason. After that, Emma and I look at some different issues within biology and the projects that she is currently working on. Then we discuss the relationship between science and theology. If you have questions or topics that you'd like to hear on the show, you can send me a message at rtmullins.com. Well, ready or not, here's Emma and I chatting about God and science. Enjoy. All right, so in today's episode, we want to look at some different listener questions because we get a lot of different questions into the website, but I've just kind of been answering a lot of them by myself without writing them down. But I noticed different patterns like that people are asking a lot of times, like they're asking the same kind of questions.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're going to do today is we're going to talk about some specific questions that people have asked, and then so I've just kind of lumped together a bunch of common questions that we keep getting to the show. So that's what we're going to do today.
Okay. Well, should I start from the first question then?
Yeah, go ahead and start for the first question.
Right? So, I know you wrote a paper recently. Well, you wrote a lot of paper.
I did.
But this came, you got a lot of messages about this paper recently. And the paper is about the problem of arbitrary creation for impassibility. And one of the common questions that people can ask you is, why can the classical theist just deny that God is perfectly rational? That would avoid the problem of arbitrary creation. But I don't know, it sounds a bit weird. What do you think about this?
I found this really, really bizarre. And I had several people recommend this to me. They're like, why couldn't you just say that? And I'm like...
So the idea is like to make God irrational.
Well, they don't want to
avoid
say that.
This problem.
Yeah, they don't want to say he's irrational, but I'm okay. Like, you just denied he's perfectly rational. Mm-hmm. What do you want to say about him? So
he's kind of halfway irrational, whatever that means.
Kind of. Let me back up a little bit.
Right.
And so I could kind of like say a little bit of the problem and then say a little bit of what it means to be perfectly rational and then kind of answer this question. So what I do in that paper is I focus on this conflict between like three claims that classical theists explicitly make. Mm-hmm. So I'm focusing on this is what classical theism says itself. And so here are the three claims that they make. They say that God's impassible, God is perfectly rational, and God created the universe. And so then what I do is I take these three classical claims and I'm like, I'll drive a contradiction out of these. And so if you get a contradiction, then you got to deny one of those three.
Mm-hmm. That's bad, I guess.
Yeah. And I was like, well, nobody's going to deny, if you're a classical theist, you can't deny that God created the universe. If you're a theist of some sort, you're going to be saying, of course,
yes.
God created the universe.
Sounds pretty essential.
Yeah. And then I was like, well, no one's going to want to deny that God's perfectly rational because like everybody and their mother has affirmed that throughout history.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, well, then the only other thing left to reject is impassibility. But then I got all these messages saying, well, like, why don't they just reject God's perfectly rational? I was like, what?
Excuse Hang me? On. They're right. happy to go with God is impossible.
Yeah.
That's just so weird.
Well, if they're committed to classical theism, like, you know, that's...
So it's better having a God that has no emotion whatsoever, but is completely irrational.
Right. Well,
that's good.
The kind of suggestion was maybe he's beyond rationality, or
oh,
rationality
yeah, the
isn't
beyond
really
stuff.
The beyond stuff, you know.
Yes.
He's beyond existence, whatever that means.
Yeah.
You know, it's not atheism, I swear.
Oh, I love philosophy so much.
Right. It's not, yeah. So at some point, we'll do a whole episode just like on this paper. We'll go through the details and more.
Can't wait for that.
Right. It'll be a fun one, I'm certain, because you love going through like the really nitty gritty details
I
of
do,
these.
I do, because it's like, this is just so crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot believe you have to specify this.
There are a lot of times where I'm like, I can't believe I have to specify this.
Mm-hmm.
This should be one like theology 101, but
hey, that's the way
there's a reason I'm a reluctant theologian. So here's kind of what I was looking at. So like mm-hmm. so like I said, like the classical tradition.
So
like,
what's the problem here?
So they affirm that God's perfectly rational.
Okay.
And so I want to say, like, if you deny God's perfect rationality, like first thing you're doing is you're denying classical theism itself, because they say God's perfectly rational. And so I'm like, well, you can't defend classical theism by denying things that classical theism affirms.
Yeah. The thing that should be like,
you know,
in there somewhere.
It should be in there somewhere. But there's an even stronger claim that I want to make, which is if you deny God's perfect rationality, you're not going to be able to systematically articulate like really basic divine attributes that are not only essential to classical theism, but essential to just any model of God. So let me give you some details here. So here's what it means to say that God's perfectly rational. So it just means that God is perfectly rational means that God always acts for a reason. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And God's perfect rationality, it's systematically connected to other divine attributes. So here's an example of one. God's perfectly wise. This is all throughout the scriptures, Hebrew Bible, New Testament, Islam. They're pretty big on God being perfectly wise. Who wants to deny that? But I'm like, well, you know, if you deny that God's perfectly rational, then I don't know what it means to say that God is perfectly wise. Because typically when you see Jews, Christians, and Muslims talk about God creating the universe, they say God created the universe through his wisdom and that his providential plan, like his providence, is in accordance with his unsurpassable, like, you know, his absolutely perfect wisdom. And so I'm like, okay, well, if you deny that God's perfectly rational, that he always acts for a reason, then what is all this talk about, you know, he's doing it in accordance with his wisdom? I think you've lost the plot. Mm-hmm. But here are two other attributes that I think theists of all stripes, they want to affirm. And if they deny it, they deny perfect rationality, they're going to lose their analysis of these other things. So this is God's goodness, his perfect goodness. Everyone wants to say that. Mm-hmm. And then his perfect freedom. And again, every model of God that I'm aware of wants to say that God's perfectly free. So I'll start with goodness. Lots of philosophers say that God is a perfectly good person. And what that means is he always does what he has most objective reason to do. Because that's part of what it means to be morally good, is you have you act for reasons, and your reasons are based on what, you know, like responding to like the values in the world.
Right. So if you're rational, you have to be good?
Seems like it. If you're perfectly rational, you're going to be acting in accordance with what you have most objective reason to do. Okay. And the most objective reason to do, well, what would that be? It would be good actions. Because if you're doing bad actions, a lot of moral philosophers want to say, well, that's irrational. It's a very big part of the moral tradition in East and West that like the rational thing to do is the morally good thing to do.
Okay.
Yeah. Sometimes like it feels like these things come apart. We exploit different theories. Like
I can feel movies. Like sometimes you could have like some loopholes.
Yeah.
In there.
Yeah.
But that are loophole, not a general rule.
Right. And most moral theories, they don't want to have those loopholes, but those are the things that moral philosophers love to point out. Be like, seems like you got a problem here. It seems like your concept of what's the right thing to do and the rational thing to do seems like they come apart. And we do this in movies all the time. So like all the new Batman movies, like they've got the Joker like exploiting like different theories all the time and stuff. But there's this kind of general consensus that part of whatever it means for God to be good is that he acts in accordance with whatever he has most objective reason to do. And so that's not the whole story of God's perfect goodness. You have to fill that out with your other, whatever else you want to have in your moral theory. But that's, you know, part of the major story. And so if you deny that God's perfect rational, then I want to say you've lost this really intuitive account of God's goodness. And that seems bad. Now it comes to freedom. Mm-hmm. So here's what freedom means.
Freedom can be related. I find it hard to make the connection.
Well, you know, we're in Scotland, so you would think that like freedom really matters here. But well, let's not make any political statements.
Let's not make a political statement.
No, I was going to just make a Mel Gibson reference instead. So what it means for God to be free, classically understood. So I'm just focusing on what the classical tradition understands it. So God is free, and that God is the source of his action, and that God has the ability to do otherwise. Mm-hmm. But lots of philosophers historically and today, so people in the classical tradition and today, they maintain that there's this reasons constraint on freedom. And so a free action is an action that's performed for a reason. So if you perform some action like without a reason, a lot of philosophers, including classical tradition, would say, well, that's not really, it's not technically an action, or it's not definitely not a free action.
Okay.
Because part of what it means to act freely is you act for a reason. Mm-hmm. So if God's perfectly free, what that means is, in the very traditional analysis of God's freedom, is that his actions are always going to be guided by rational considerations alone, always going to be guided by reasons. And so if you deny that God is perfectly rational, you're going to be losing this really standard analysis of divine freedom. So I think if you deny perfect rationality, it's not that it sinks the entire idea of God, like his perfect goodness or his freedom or his wisdom, but it certainly sinks a very, very traditional analysis of those things and very intuitive analyses of those things. And I don't know what you replace it with.
Absolutely, because, you know, the bearded guy sitting on a river in a Zen way. It has to be rational.
Gotta be rational. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So I wouldn't allow, you know, their perfectly happy God. I just thought, you know, if you're going to have this perfectly happy God, the impassible God, he's got to be perfectly rational because that's what they want.
Yep.
And then get all these people saying, what if we get rid of it? I'm like, okay, well, there's consequences.
So, Ryan, what is so bad about performing an arbitrary action? Why can God do that sometimes?
So I think there are two senses of arbitrary that we don't always like identify when we're talking. So one sense, like an arbitrary action, it's an action that's performed for literally no reason at all. And most of the time we think that's just really bad. We think that's irrational. And we get really mad at our politicians. We get really mad at like leaders when they do that because we think like...
Well, some action that not... You know, that you perform all the time that don't have any reason.
Right.
Like moving a glass from left to the right. Who cares?
Well, that seems like you're just fidgeting at that point. And so that's... What? You're fidgeting. Okay, because that might be more like an American kind of like English word. But like you're just fidgeting. And like that's not a free action really in any meaningful sense.
It's an action. And that's a free action. Nobody's stopping me to do it.
I guess, but like maybe because like with my ADHD, like... I'm constantly fidgeting. I'm always playing with my hair or my ring or something.
You do, yeah.
These are not conscious actions I'm doing. These are not free actions I'm doing. I'm just doing it. So it's not really... And so I think a lot of people would say that's not a free action.
Right.
The free action would be me like grabbing like the bottom of my chair to prevent myself from fidgeting.
Okay.
Yeah. So I want to say those aren't free actions. Those are just unconscious.
Okay.
My hands are just doing stuff, you know? But like... So, like, I want to say, like, there's, like, in a sense, like, where there's, like an utterly arbitrary action is one where it's performed for no reason whatsoever. And I would think those are bad. But there's another sense in which I think we do perform actions that seem like they're for no reason whatsoever, but they're actually nested in with, like, a context of where we're trying to perform a course of actions.
So like you're leading to something.
Yes.
Okay.
So what I want to call these nested arbitrary actions. So Keith Yandell, I remember him giving a lecture on this where he said sometimes... God might have to perform nested arbitrary actions. And he's like, that's not a big deal.
That was the guy you were driving around.
Yeah. So this was the professor that I had during my master's he was a professor at Wisconsin, Madison, but he would also teach these weekend classes in Trinity in Chicago.
That was the person that told you that philosophy never started before 11 o'clock?
I think he said 10 a.m.
Okay, 10 a.m.
Yeah, philosophy is best done after 10 in the morning. And I...
That's right.
That's gospel truth, you know? He
in your word, it is.
Yes. That man knew exactly what he was talking about. And he also had a love of cheeseburgers and Portillo's hot dogs.
That's why you guys were so close.
These are one of the many reasons why Keith Yandell and I got along all the time. But he had this idea of like a nested arbitrary action. And so the idea is like you've got like a rational course of actions you're going to perform. But like if something, you might have to make some like seemingly arbitrary actions along the way in order to keep the course running. So let me give you some examples of like kind of how some of these debates to go.
Yeah, please.
So in the Islamic tradition, there's this guy named Al-Ghazali. Al-Ghazali says, like, imagine like there's two delicious dates in front of you.
Sounds a bit creepy.
Well, no, not like a tender date. Like
like
the fruit, you know?
Oh, dates.
Dates.
See. Fruits.
Right.
Oh, it has to specify the fruit.
Yeah. It would be more interesting if Al-Ghazali was like, imagine you've got two like smoking hot dates in front of you. Like, which one are you going to do? But that's not what he's thinking. Like, he's thinking like these fruits. And I don't really like these fruits. So like, let's change the example to like these. So imagine you've got two equally delectable cheeseburgers in front of you.
Yes. That's more fitting, babe.
Yeah. So you're hungry. and you can only eat one cheeseburger. Which one do you select? And Al-Ghazali is like, well, look, it's just an arbitrary
act. Yeah, it doesn't matter. They're both equally good.
Yeah, so just go for one. And Al-Ghazali is like, we do this all the time. And he's like, there's no big deal. Like, and so there's nothing irrational about this. There's nothing that undermines your freedom about this. So if you can perform an arbitrary action like that, then and you're still rational. Mm-hmm. Well, then so can God. And so he's just dismisses all these kind of like worries that arise from God's perfect rationality. And so he's just like, yeah, there's no big deal. We just perform perform arbitrary actions all the time, and they're not irrational. So God can do the same. But a later thinker in the Islamic tradition named Averroes, he's like, whoa, not so fast. Like, that's he says, like, that's not really an arbitrary action, at least not in the sense of literally acting for no reason. And so Avro says, like, if you're presented with these two equally delectable cheeseburgers, he says your choice is not really between these two cheeseburgers. He's like, in that case, your choice is between either eating or starving to death. And so the rational thing to do is you just eat one of the cheeseburgers. So
it sounds a bit more radical, though, here. Mm. I think he's putting more things into the table because it feels like I have two cheeseburgers. I'm happy to have them both. Doesn't matter. And now if it became a question of life and death.
Oh, sure.
So much pressure there.
Well, you can modify it in either way. Like, something is, but like the background, like assumptions are supposed to be like, well, you want to eat something. Yeah. Like, there's a reason for eating. You're hungry. Or just because cheeseburgers are amazing. Maybe you're not really that hungry, but you're like, I want a cheeseburger. Okay. I know I can only eat one. I really would love to eat two, but like, I will
have only room for one.
I've only got room for one. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, well, then your options are either just be completely frustrated in your desire to eat a cheeseburger,
right,
or just grab one. And so I think that really illustrates this idea of like this nested arbitrary act, because it's nested in the context of a rational course of action.
Mm-hmm.
And so Sam Liebens and Tyrone Goldschmidt, they've got a couple of papers on this. And so the way they put it is like, God always acts for a reason unless God has a reason not to.
Hmm.
And it's a very like cheeky, kind of like tongue in cheek sort of way of saying God always acts for a reason, because in some cases, God has good reason to act in a way that seems arbitrary, because it's like, God always acts for a reason unless he's got good reason not to. And you're like, well, he has a good reason not to do
right?
And so,
yes.
so you still get the reason in there. Yes. And that's what I love about Sam and Tyrone, because like they always find these like fun ways to say this stuff.
I want to meet these people one day, because you told me so many wonderful things about them.
Yeah, they're great people. Very great people. So I think what's going on is it's rationally acceptable to like put forth some sort of project that you have a good reason to do. And then that project might include having to make the occasional like nested arbitrary action within it. So like your project, like you might have like really good reasons to do like all of the project as a whole, but with these nested arbitrary acts, if you fail to do one of those, then your entire project falls apart. So so your reason for acting arbitrarily is either perform, like make some kind of arbitrary decision, or my entire rational project falls apart. So you've got good reason to make sure your entire project doesn't fail.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a great example of this that like based on my sister. So like my parents, they bought a new house like a few years ago, and this contractor was like redoing the bedroom that was gonna be my sister's. And the contractor like came up to my dad and was like, all right, well, we need to paint the walls some color. I already know Kelly is going to want pink.
Oh, well, yes. I mean, definitely. Yeah. Your sister would love to have pink room.
Yeah. She wanted a pink room. And the contractor already knew this. Like, he'd met Kelly enough times to be like, she's going to want pink walls.
Just say pink, 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 pink.
Yeah. And so he didn't even have to ask that question. So what he did instead, he came to my dad and he's like, I already know she's going to want pink. So here are some different like color samples of some different pinks.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it's just these different paints, like swatches. And like the pinks, like you can't, I can't tell the difference between these pinks.
And you're a guy.
Well, no, Kelly couldn't either. Like none of us really could. And like they each are like seem pretty equal because like, oh, this one's got a 5-year warranty. Well, this one's got a, like a 5.5-year warranty or something.
I see what you mean.
Right. Yeah. And so there's all these slight variations in it, but like,
mm-hmm.
really like there's not like much of a difference. And so my dad shows Kelly like these different like pink samples and like, which one do you want? And Kelly just like stares at them. Like she can't see a difference. She just stares at them like, and doesn't say anything. And so my dad gets really frustrated and he's like, look, Kelly, like you just pick one of them. Mm-hmm. You want a pink wall. Here's some pink. If you don't make a decision, you don't get a pink wall.
Wow.
And all of a sudden Kelly just goes, that one. Because when she saw it framed in this way of like, yes. You're not going to get pink wall. That's your goal here, is to get a pink wall.
Yes.
That's if you don't just pick one, you're not going to mm-hmm. get a pink wall. And so that's what Averroes is basically making us like think about, like, what's the real context here for this action? So is this really an arbitrary act, or is it nested within the context of like a rational project, like that you have good reason to do?
Right.
And so my sister, it seems like she really loves pink, so she's got a good reason to want pink walls.
And she just went for it.
She's got to pick one of them. She just goes for it. So I think if you apply this to God, you could say that like God could perform some like nested arbitrary actions.
Mm-hmm.
So if he's got good reasons for wanting to do a particular project, like create a particular kind of universe with particular things in it, if he's got a good reason to do that, if he's got like two equally best universes that both satisfy whatever his reasons mm-hmm. are, just arbitrarily pick one, that doesn't seem like a big deal because it's within this overall rational context.
Right. Yes.
So I think there might be some cases like that. But that's very different than what the classical theist would have to do, because my problem for arbitrary creation, that's saying like, you don't even have this, you can't even get this rational context up and running. So it's really bad.
It sounds like it.
Yeah. So let's look at this next listener question, though.
Right.
So here's one I kept getting into the website that I thought was really funny, that I thought would really tickle you. A lot of people are asking, like, what you're working on.
Oh, me?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Well, because a lot of people, they're like, what's Emma's background? Like, what's her research? Like,
no, she's, like, in there, but is this shit really there?
Right, because they've got all these questions about, like, your philosophical intuitions and, like, your philosophical, like, background. Like, what kind of tradition is she coming from? And like, well, she's a biologist. And they're like, oh, okay. So, like, a lot of them are like, they want to know, like, yeah. What's your research background? What are you working on?
Okay, so me and Ryan are very different. I'm a scientist, whatever that means. I am a molecular biologist. I'm working at the University of Edinburgh. And through my years, I did a lot of different things. So, yeah, I was a plant scientist at the beginning of my PhD. Then I moved to yeast, you know, the same organism that make beer and bread, but mainly beers. That's why we love them. And now during the pandemic, with our lab decided to switch to coronaviruses research, because what I was doing before in East, I was actually an RNA biologist, and coronavirus, COVID-19 in particular, is an RNA virus. So we thought, as RNA biologists, we have a lot to say on this. So now I'm researching on different coronaviruses that infect humans, because not only COVID-19 is infecting humans, but other 7 strains of coronaviruses. But some of them just give you a cold, and some of them are really, really nasty, like COVID-19, but also SARS and MERS, you might remember them. So my research now is to compare all these 7 strains that are around in the world and understand why some of them just give you a cold and some of them potentially kill you.
Right.
So that's what my research is doing at the moment.
Okay. So not really related to God.
No. Not at all. Well, you know, as a scientist, I ask myself bigger questions once in a while.
Right. So speaking of that, that brings us to the next question that I get. So this one's like typically directed at me, but I want to direct it at you first.
Ah, man. Yes.
So a lot of people ask me like what's one of your big like pet peeves or like something that really annoys you about like the research you're doing. And so I wanted to ask you this. So like now that you're starting to get into some of the science and theology literature, some of the dialogue, like what's one of the things that like, you see that really annoys you?
So one of the things that really doesn't really annoy me, I was very surprised when a few years ago, 2 years ago, was Ryan?
If it's a story I'm thinking about, you're going to tell. Yeah, it'll be about 2 years
ago. I'm not
going
to tell the whole story, sure. But anyway, I got invited to this seminar that Ryan was presenting in a few years ago in St. Andrews. I would say, why not? I'm curious about philosophy and theologies. I want to hear about your research. I'll come through. And when I was sitting there, I was sit next to someone that was doing theology, but also was interested in science and relationship between theology and science. And I was amazed because I was keep talking to this person. I was keeping referring to like, science thinks this, science thinks that. And I'm like, wait a second, science? What is science? Who are those people? I'm a scientist, but I don't even call myself a scientist. I'm a molecular biologist, which is very, very defined.
Yeah.
I don't know what a physics thinks. I don't know what a chemist thinks. I'm pretty sure we have very different opinion. And these things about science and scientists been keeping thrown around, he really struck me like, I'm sorry, bro, there is not such a common ground between scientists at all. And I felt so bad because this guy was like, at the end of his PhD and trying really hard, and it was very, very disheartening at the end.
I just remember being in another conversation and looking over and hearing you say something like, No scientist would ever say that.
I know.
And seeing this guy's face just drop and me just going, don't laugh, because I'm in this other conversation and whatever they were saying was not funny. So I was like, I can't laugh at this moment. But
it was difficult because I don't think a scientific perspective exists.
Mm-hmm.
Because even in, I'm a molecular biologist, as I say, and I've always been working on yeast and plants. So I have kind of a common ground for people that work in my little field.
Right.
But even if I'm going biology and talking to someone that does humans, for example,
mm-hmm.
they have a very different perspective on things. They value things and they think that some issues are more important than others, but for me are like, I have a very different opinion on other things. So we cannot really agree on anything. And this is just people that are working on very small specific field of molecular biology.
Mm-hmm.
So if you start to broaden up, and I compare myself with engineering, physics, we talk such a different language.
Yes.
Which is so hard to, first, to understand each other.
Yeah.
And secondly, find some common ground that we all agree. So the idea of having a scientific perspective on something is just so laughable. I'm sorry. I should be more charitable, but
no.
It's like, it's so hard because I cannot imagine this existing.
The scientific perspective.
No, I don't know what the science perspective is.
Yeah. No, I've loved this for several years when I hear people say like, well, but science teaches us. And I'm like,
which
scientist, like what scientist are you talking to? I have no idea. Because I get this all the time as well. Like people are like, well, science teaches that like all moments of time are simultaneous. And I'm like, No science teaches that. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, because, you know, some people in physics, we have some, you know,
some theories they're working with, yeah.
That they're working on, but I'm working as a biologist. Everything has a cause effect.
Yes.
So I can't go away from that.
Yeah, you can't play the game that some physicists do where they're like, there's no cause and effect. And
exactly. Other physicists are like, so for me, it's like, what?
Mm-hmm.
If a molecule hit another molecule for create something different, you know, making a biochemistry reaction happen,
right. That
can only go one way.
Right.
Cannot go back.
Exactly.
But I understand that, like, for some mathematician, you can make the equation switch and going back.
Yeah.
But that's not my word. So what's a scientist's perspective at that point?
I know. And this is what really tickled me. So I spent like a few years of my PhD hanging out with, I was in this physics and philosophy society. And so I was meeting a lot of different physicists, and then we had two different chemists in the society as well, and hearing them talk about a bunch of different things. So like, we looked at this one problem of like, you know, there's no causation in the fundamental physical laws. The two chemists were like, well, that's just stupid. We know that there is causation. Like, why are you even bothered? How could you be bothered by that? Like, we know there's causation. Like, they just didn't understand where this could even arise.
Yeah, I have biologists, I think, have many limitations. I cannot do maths, for example.
Sure.
That's a funny joke that, you know, all everybody say about biologists, they can't do maths.
They can't do
maths. Yes. I can do other things. I can genetically modify you some organs, if you like.
Sure, sure.
But I can't do maths.
But you can't do the math.
Yeah, sorry.
That's fine. But what I love about hanging out with lots of different kinds of scientists is seeing that they have radically different perspectives on everything. And so, like, I guess I have two thoughts. One of which is, I remember hanging out with a bunch of people in your lab once, and I was trying to run some ideas, and I was like, you know, this is very similar to the kind of reasoning in physics, and hearing a very prominent biologist she has the title of what, like, she's a commander of the British Army.
Mm-hmm.
Saying physics is not a real science. That's not real science.
Yeah.
That's
been thrown around a lot.
Yeah.
Yep.
That tickled me. And that's not the first time I've heard someone from a different scientific discipline say some other discipline, that's not a real science. I hear that all the time.
I love that. Every science is better than the other science.
Exactly. So that's one thing that tickles me. Another thing that tickles me is how often when I talk to some scientists and I start trying to ask them these bigger philosophical questions, a lot of them get really anxious and they're going like, the evidence only points towards this really super tiny, limited little thing.
Yeah.
And they don't want to make any statement beyond that.
That's so true, because I think most of scientists, they really believe in data.
Yes.
And what data tells you, it's very limiting.
Yes.
And most of people don't like to take a guess beyond the data. So it makes it very hard. Like, you guys are very, it's philosopher or theologian, mm-hmm. they're very happy to speculate a lot of people, a lot of things. But for us, it's like, I don't want to speculate. This is what I get. I know it has very limited possibility, but I can tell you that this possibility are real.
Yes.
Anything beyond that, I'm not even interested to engage the conversation.
Right.
Until I get better data, I don't want to take any guess. I don't want to bet on anything.
Yeah. And that's what's been really fascinating to me. Like, even as like we've done like some interviews with some of your friends, mm-hmm. Some of the different scientists, like when we figure out some of these bigger philosophical questions, like some of them get so nervous and they'll go and like read a bunch of papers on a topic before they weigh in on it. Whereas I compare to people who are doing like the science religion dialogue, they'd be like, oh, well, science says this. And I'm like, I just spoke to a scientist who's an expert on this topic the other day, and they aren't willing to make any statement anywhere near remotely like that. Like,
yeah, we get very nervous mm-hmm. When we are asked to speculate.
Yes.
Because, you know, we like to have solid foundation of very small things. Because in the end, we are all very focused on a very narrow subject.
Yes.
But we want to have a really good grasp on that very small thing. Mm-hmm. And anything beyond can be put into question.
Yeah.
And that's when philosophy starts and science ends.
Right. And I think that's right to me. So I've often tried to think, like, why are theologians doing this? I think one of the issues is theologians, like, we're used to trying to, like build an entire world.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were like, okay, so we've got God in the picture, and we've got all these different doctrines, and we're trying to figure out how the entire world fits together.
Right.
And it does involve some kind of speculation. A lot of what analytic theology is trying to do is, like, let's pare back some of this. Let's try to, like, make as minimal claims as possible and really see how, like, mm-hmm. tight arguments we can give.
Yeah.
A lot of theologians are not used to that. They're used to making a lot of dogmatic claims and say, like, well, we've got this one authority, like the Bible, and we've got this other authority, the tradition. And mm-hmm. so we can make all these wild, like, really, like, grand claims. Well, what's another, like, source of ultimate authority for us that we can use? The science.
Right.
The science says this. And you're like, you read a popularized science book.
Yes.
And it made these claims.
But, you know, I feel sometimes that scientists should be a bit more wild.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay. They're a bit too cautious, a bit too boring.
Yeah. Not too boring. I think sometimes they should be more daring and feeling that they can push the boundary. Because I feel like now the way science is very constrained of more like, get a paper out.
Sure.
Tell me a story, a very small, specific story, but mm-hmm. I want a story about that.
Yeah.
And we lost kind of the drive to see the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's our problem at the moment. We should be more mm-hmm. like taken to see a whole complete vision of things that can be rather than a very focused mechanism that, it could be very exciting to understand how things work.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be nice to have a bigger context there.
I think that's right. So I don't know because I've told you about natural philosophy before, so science wasn't always called science. It mm-hmm. was just like, even when Isaac Newton was writing, he called his book, the natural philosophy.
Yeah.
So there was a few years ago, Lee Smolin, who's a physicist and a cosmologist, he co-authored a book with a philosopher named Peter Unger. And the whole project was, we need a new natural philosophy. We've lost this idea. We're doing all these very highly specialized things. We don't have a single vision of reality. And so they're like, we need a single vision of reality where you've got actual time existing. You've got actual simultaneity, not all this like nonsense that we've supposedly learned from like relativity. Mm-hmm. They're like, get rid of all that. And I'm like, a physicist is saying this. Thank you. Please keep going. And they're like, we need a vision of a single unified reality.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we've lost that completely. Yeah. We need to get back to that. We need a new natural philosophy. To undergird all the scientific work we're doing.
Yeah, no, I understand that. But to put this into a reality check is going to be very difficult. Because, for doing some of the things I'm doing through my job, you really have to be specialized. Because unfortunately, or fortunately, depending the way you want to see it,
mm-hmm.
literature now is massive.
Yes.
You cannot keep up with literature. So we are not in the 17th century anymore.
No.
I have like 15 papers a week that I should read very carefully about my work.
Mm-hmm.
with back then it was probably a book a year that should know about my work.
Exactly.
So I feel now the level and the amount of information is so much.
It is.
Which make it very, very hard for a scientist to have a bigger picture of anything and be still competitive and knowledgeable in its field. So this balance is so hard to get. And I don't have the recipe to make things different.
No.
Because we're all very busy with, you know, writing papers, doing our experiments that 90% of time fail.
Right.
And we have to repeat over and over. So I don't know how to fit the idealized idea of scientists looking at the world.
Right.
Compared to the actual reality of scientists in the lab try to juggle between writing papers, finish experiments, teaching, and I don't know, everything else.
Yeah.
It's, I think we are in a very hard time and we are demanding a lot from people.
That seems right to me, because when I look at the scientific revolution, that's also the same time period where the idea of an encyclopedia, people are wanting to write encyclopedias.
Mm-hmm.
And they really thought, like, we can have this, like, all knowledge condensed into this, like, you know, set of books.
Yes.
And there we go. There's the book of the world right there in several
volumes.
That'd be
amazing, but yeah. I feel like how many books you have to write now.
Right, exactly. And so now, like, that, I do find that task to be somewhat impossible, somewhat daunting. But I guess when I look at popular culture and when I look at a lot of theologians who want to try to be engaged with, like, the scientific literature... Mm-hmm. I think they're creating these idols where they're thinking, we've got these Renaissance men like back in the day when, you know, you read a few books, you were like a master of everything.
Right.
And I'm like, no, we don't have those. Those days are long gone. You're talking about a person who has a highly specialized, super, super narrow focus.
Yeah.
They can tell you a whole lot about a single molecule or a single aspect of the universe. Writing the whole story of the world, you can't ask a single scientist to do that. That is not irrational, but it's a pipe dream. It seems a fantasy to me.
Yeah, and you know, you have some people that want to know about other things happening in other fields.
Mm-hmm.
You have some people that are very interested in that. You have other people that are not interested in that at all.
Yes.
And you have to deal with that.
Yeah.
But also I feel like I will totally welcome scientists and philosopher and even other branches of scientists, like, as I say, I'm a molecular biologist. Mm. I would love to have some physics come because and help me out with some problem I'm facing right now, because it's really true that scientists all interconnect with each other. So especially in the project I'm on right mm-hmm. now, where I really have to look at some protein that behave in a very difficult way if you're a biologist, mm-hmm. to see them, because you have to start to take in account about some physical property.
Right.
Which I'm not very accustomed to look at. So I really feel like an interdisciplinary call is really needed.
Yeah.
But it's hard in reality to have this happening.
It is.
It really is. And I don't have the recipe right now to tell you how we should do this. I wish I had it, but I find fascinating when I'm talking to Ryan and whatever research he's doing, because it's really opened so many questions for me, which maybe I don't have an answer when we're talking about at the time, but I kind of dwell on this later on, and you know, it's very good, and it's helped me a lot on my research perspective, on what things that matter that I should do as well. So I think it would be very good to having like people from other discipline, especially philosopher and theologian, like guiding scientists in a different way,
mm-hmm.
to make them think what they're actually doing, because it's when you're on your bench and just moving water or other buffer
mm-hmm.
from a tube to another, you get so lost in your experiment, and you really miss what you're actually doing beyond just moving things around.
Yeah. So as you're seeing it, so this need for more multidisciplinary stuff, it's having people from these different disciplines sit down and talk to each other about some of the bigger questions, and also some of these really smaller specific questions that you're doing in your own research. But the way you kind of like described it, it looks different than what a lot of philosophy of science does. So a lot of philosophy of science just says, scientists, you tell us what's going on, we'll figure out some of the theory behind it. We'll justify the theory behind it.
Well, I guess you need that to, you know, if you want to discuss in a very philosophical way of what is a theory, mm-hmm. what is a science, what do you need science, all these philosophical questions.
Sure.
But I feel like things should go in both ways.
Yeah.
Like science also needs sometimes be reminded of why you're doing certain things.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm not just doing for my next grant.
Yeah.
Or my next paper.
Yeah.
Which is nice because you get some money out there.
Yeah.
But it's also nice to think about, I'm doing science because I really want to advance humanity. Mm-hmm. And this is a bigger question.
Yes.
This is a bigger quest as well.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But it's just so, you just get so lost when you're in your mm-hmm. bench and you have to do your day-to-day task to get your experiment, because, you know, Brian, we talked about a lot of time, I'm so jealous of, easy is for you to write a paper, just sit there and think about some theory, read some books, and there you go, paper out.
Yeah.
But I'm spending like months and months sitting on my bench, and sometimes the experiment does just not work, and I don't understand why it doesn't work. Sometimes like my pH in the buffer is slightly wrong, so the reaction doesn't work. So I spend literally like weeks and weeks and weeks trying to perfect in something. And then eventually a year after, I have one answer.
Right.
But I don't have a paper. I have one answer. That's what I have.
Yeah. Whereas if I encounter like some problems in my argument, then I'm like, oh, well, I'll just run an argument against this theory that I thought was true. There we go. Aha. Like, so I can always turn a negative result into a paper.
Yeah. Well, in scientists, oh my God, this other thing that negative results are basically non-results.
Right.
I can try, you know, I worked very hard to prove some theory that I mm-hmm. was really passionate about, and I never got consistent results. Because sometimes you have technical limitation, or sometimes you have like biology, it just doesn't work that way. You have a theory, it's mm. a beautiful theory, all the evidence point to that direction, and then when you do the final experiment, sorry, nope, biology just nope, doesn't work that way.
It just doesn't.
So you and but now you are 2 years down the line, and you got nothing. You know exactly how and why things do not work, but you can't publish that. Nobody's interested into that. And what are you going to do?
This is something I find so depressing about science, because, again, like, if I am really pursuing some sort of theory and I figure out exactly why it doesn't work, well, then I publish that. I'm like, this is why this idea just doesn't work.
Nobody would be interested in that, because the first argument would be, well, you didn't do the experiment properly.
Mm-hmm.
Something in your buffer, something in your reaction is wrong. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't work. We can't trust you. Okay. I can assure you that everything was done properly.
Yeah.
But disprove a theory is so much hard work than proving a theory.
Mm.
And there is no really way out of that at the moment.
At the moment, at least. At least the way like the current culture is with science. Yeah. Mm. Mm. It's a hard road.
And there you have it, another episode of the Reluctant Theologian Podcast. Stay tuned for episodes on heavy metal and space-time.